Hello, friends. Welcome back to Tay Talks. I hope the conversations so far have been landing with you. Today you'll meet Ashley Christman. Ashley Christman and I first met when I was actually on the clinical side, helping her navigate some treatment options. She was looking into a potential clinical trial for her really rare neuroendocrine cancer. And from day one, she really impressed me with the way that she tackled treatment. She was fully engaged in every decision. Neuroendocrine tumor patients tend to be very involved in their care, but Ashley was at another level of really figuring it all out. And she did all of that while raising a son, keeping up her marine level fitness, juggling work, family, and flying coast to coast for consults. But Ashley's here today not because of her resume or even the fight with cancer that she's had. She's here because I feel like she turns every setback into a spotlight. And you'll see from our conversation today that this really has been throughout her whole life. This year, she spoke at our annual NANET Symposium, which is a meeting that is targeted towards neuroendocrine tumor providers. And in a room of almost 500 seasoned clinicians, you could hear a pin drop while she was talking. Her patient perspective was equal parts, I would say, empathy, precision, and reminding every provider in that room why the work we do matters. So Ashley really inspires me to keep up a really optimistic lens on life every day. And I'm thrilled for you guys to hear her story. I hope you enjoy.
And I watched this airplane go right over the swim area, and it was literally feet off the surface of the water. And on that particular day, we had about 3 daycares there in the water at the time. It's like my life in slow motion, and I still have the details just burn into my brain. And I've said for years to those that I serve as a leader and those that I mentor, success isn't found in knowing all the answers. Success is found in asking the right questions.
Do you feel like your personality at work was helpful, or it hurt you a little bit when it came to dealing with a diagnosis like that?
You know, a long way of saying, I think that helped me survive my cancer fight through the most critical time where I had to make very difficult decisions. I had to find the right experts to inform those decisions. I had to trust those experts and those doctors as leaders.
I guess, first off, your degree was in psychology. Were you planning a different path before, or did you know that's where you were going to head?
Well, I think which really brought me to working with and for people was when I was really little. I was about 5 years old, and my sister will probably kill me for sharing this story, but I was 5 years old, and I was at the pool with my mom and my sister and my dad, and my sister, who's just a little over a year older than I am, started to choke when we were at the concession stand. And I remember a man came running over and grabbed her up in his arms and gave her the Heimlich maneuver, and she was able to breathe again. And it was just a formative moment for me. And I just never forgot being that young, that feeling of helplessness and the fear and the, you know, the worry about somebody that I love so much. She's not just my sister. She's my best friend. She like felt like an extra appendage on my body because we were just so close. And it was just terrifying, you know, but I never wanted to feel that helpless again with somebody that I love so much. And I wanted to be able to take care of people. And I think that really shaped how I proceeded throughout my life. I started studying emergency medicine when I was about 14 years old, became a certified first responder at 14, and then again at 16, and then at 18, got my EMT certification and nationally registered EMT, and then was a basic life support instructor at 18. I mean, just again, probably not typical, but it was just phenomenal. And I was very fortunate to have programs like that available where I lived in Minnesota at the time. And then I, you know, went off to college for a year, came back for the summer, and I was working as an assistant head lifeguard at a lake. This was summer of 1999. Not a real exciting job there. You know, we didn't anticipate serious dangers per se. It was a roped off area, and we might on a really busy day have a couple hundred kids in the water, right? But it wasn't real deep. It probably goes up, it was about thigh deep on me. So hanging out at the lake lifeguarding. And one day, unexpectedly, just sitting up in the chair, and I hear this sound that was just all consuming. And I'm looking around, what is that noise? And I look up, and over top my head, this airplane comes like shooting down over top, right? And it was so close. I'm sitting up in a lifeguard chair. Yeah. So close, I felt like if I reached up, I could have touched it. Just totally unexpected, as you can imagine. And I watched this airplane go right over the swim area, and it was literally feet off the surface of the water. And on that particular day, we had about 3 daycares there in the water at the time. It's like my life in slow motion, and I still have the details just burn into my brain. It cleared the swim area by about 5 or 10 feet, crashed into the water, several hundred people in the water at the time, and everybody just froze and just fell silent. I had this hair of a second in my mind where I thought to myself, somebody's got to help him. And then I thought, oh, that's me. And I just took off running, blowing my whistle and running through the water straight out of Baywatch and got my little floaty behind me. And then your training takes over, right?
Yeah.
But and then at the same time as I'm running in, it's like a sea of people just running out of the water because I'm screaming, clear the water, clear the water. Yeah. Everybody comes running out. And so I get to the airplane. I remember looking back and one of the other lifeguards, my friend Beth, she was sprinting across the beach to grab the first aid kit and the backboard, and a couple of the lifeguards were standing on the beach and organizing people. There was a lot of emotion, both from the staff, we were all teenagers, and from the crowd. It became a really big ordeal with fire department and the emergency department from the hospital showing up because the pilot was trapped in the airplane.
Oh.
You know, I was standing in water about thigh deep, and I was standing in concentrated aviation fuel and controlling the bleeding because he had a pole about as big around as my
baby
that went down and hit a branch of his carotid artery. And so he was hemorrhaging. And so I'm squeezing his head. He was attached to the plane. And finally, we were able to free him with some extrication assistance from the fire department. But as is protocol for emergency response, the first responder to make contact with the patient stays in control of the scene.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was 19 years old, and I was running this scene in the care of the pilot until we got him safely out of the water onto a helicopter and flown off to the hospital. Got done with that, and I remember just standing there in a moment of reflection and thinking to myself, I think I need to do something else.
Yeah.
And at one point, I was majoring in both biology. I was pre-med, and I was double majoring in psychology. And then when I transferred schools, I ended up just staying with psychology. And so there was something that happened that predicated that change for me as well, with a friend in my first college that suffered some health challenges that really impacted me.
Yeah. Okay, so, you know, you started off on a trajectory that, I mean, your CV will be in the show notes for this. I can't even begin to describe that. But 2019, I think that was around the year that we met, right? 2019, 2020. And you were planning, I remember, a huge change, right? And then you got hit with the diagnosis of the neuroendocrine cancer, right?
I think I was moving. And I think we met actually... 22. I think it was in 2022.
Was it 22? Okay.
Yeah. It just feels like we're old friends.
Feels like, yes.
It's like it's been a long time.
Right.
Where you're like, oh man, this lady won't go away. It seems like,
no,
I'm just kidding. had to be 22.
Sure.
Yeah. Because
I'm trying to remember if we were masking or not masking and what the situation was in clinic. That's what I'm trying to remember.
I think it was sure, that's probably why you were thinking.
Right after. Yeah, that's why I was thinking it was before. Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
So moving in 2021 all the way to Southern California, and then in 2022, I came out there and saw you guys after I had gotten the diagnosis right before we moved in 2021. We started systemic therapy and we believed that it was stabilized. Mm-hmm. Turns out that I had a misread on my scan in the fall by someone who was just not as familiar with neuroendocrine cancer, which I think really was eye-opening for me as far as how involved I needed to be in my care. I just thought, well, I've got an oncologist. This is what he says. So I guess that's what I do. And then also coming to appreciate the nuances of having a rare cancer, not just mm-hmm. cancer in general,
right.
And what that means and having to find the right people to help you manage that. And I've said for years to those that I serve as a leader and those that I mentor, success isn't found in knowing all the answers. Success is found in asking the right questions. Mm-hmm. And I just was not asking the right questions initially. I think I had a lot of trust in, mm-hmm. in those that cared for me, but I had a little bit too much trust because I didn't understand the subspecialty that I needed to find a neuroendocrine cancer specialist specifically, mm-hmm. and learned it the hard way. But luckily, just barely in time.
Right in time, yeah.
I mean, we were down to the wire. So yes, yeah, so I've been very involved ever since then and worked hard to give back to others in that process too with what I learned.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like your personality at work was helpful or it hurt you a little bit when it came to dealing with a diagnosis like that?
Oh, that's interesting. Just as far as how I've been developed and energy.
I mean, you're the type of person, and correct me if I'm wrong, but the energy that you give off and the feeling that people feel when you walk into a room is that you're there and you're definitely exude a caretaker personality, right? You're a person that's looking around to see if anything is wrong, right? And now you're getting a diagnosis where that control that you usually have is taken away, right? And you have to go into another mindset, maybe. Do you feel like that mindset of I'm the one that's usually in control and I kind of have my eyes and hands everywhere helped you or made it difficult to process and you took yourself out of the equation and started looking at yourself from the outside? Or were you able to stop and then still deal with everything? And maybe this is still ongoing, right? It's not.
Yeah. I don't know that it's still ongoing. I think that now I'm kind of in a comfortable place as mm-hmm. to how to manage it and how to proceed. And I feel more confident now than ever with how to ask the right questions for my success.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting question. I would say I didn't feel out of control when it mm-hmm. hit. I don't know. I don't really feel like I'm a person that needs to be in control. I just am a person that needs to be informed. And initially, when you're talking about, you know, my personality at work, part of being a really good leader and trying as well, striving to be, I'm not claiming to be, but I do my best, man. I give it everything I've got, you know, but part of that and developing as a leader is being a good follower.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to be a good follower to be able to become a good leader. We are allowed to disagree, but we talk about things that we don't understand, or I don't know if I really agree with that. We talk about that with our senior leaders behind closed doors, and it is a discussion, and they expect candid discussions from us. And then once the decision is made, we respect the decision, whether or not voicing your thoughts or concerns has changed anything. So mm-hmm. I think that actually helped me when it came to having to make these very challenging and difficult decisions for my life and mm-hmm. for my care, is I had to have just absolute dogged pursuit over information. I had to use my education that I got from graduate school. They really push the limit as to, you know, the capacity of information that we need to consume and synthesize and process. And it prepared me to be able to do that with a whole new topic with medical information. And I don't claim to understand everything I read, but I think I do a lot better than probably the average bear, you know, a long way of saying I think that helped me survive my cancer fight through the most critical time where I had to make very difficult decisions. I had to find the right experts to inform those decisions. I had to trust those experts and the and those doctors as leaders, after having very candid conversations, I had to make sure that my information requirements were met, that I understood the level of risk and the decisions that I was making, and I needed to decide whether or not I was willing to own the risk and the decisions that I was making, and that I had to make the decisions.
What's something that you do every day that is a non-negotiable for you?
Wow. I don't know.
Okay.
I would say, I think some people would have some assumptions about what I would say with that, like,
okay. Like what?
like working out or, something particular with my family or what have you, but life is too dynamic, I think, for me to have non-negotiables in this chapter. Every day is a negotiation and navigating difficult terrain because things are just pretty chaotic right now, I think.
Okay. But, how old is your son right now?
He turns 5 here within a couple of weeks.
Oh, so
we just had his 5th birthday party the week before last. We had his preschool graduation last Friday, which was adorable. I was not expecting it to be as elaborate as it was, and it was so adorable. Oh my gosh. Yeah.
That's so sweet. What are some things that you guys do together as a family that are, I guess, special or unique for you?
Oh, we like to go hiking. That's one of the things. Ever since Archer was about 2 years old, we started to go on little hikes because one day he said, I want to go to the mountains. And we were like,
sure.
Okay, let's go to the mountains. I'm in. So we will find some hiking trails and such. We go to the park a lot. That's probably something that we do together the most. He just loves to be outside and play. He's such an active little boy. So, and he drives this little John Deere truck. It's like
I love those. Yeah.
Wheeler. And he cranks up the music and he says, I'm going to turn the music up so they can hear me. I'm like, okay.
Okay. I love that.
Yeah. It's fun.
I love that. Okay, a book that you'd reread forever.
Man, that's tough. I mean, if you could see, you see one
I
book.
I see, yes.
But I've got two more, one over there and one over there, that are like the tall stacks.
Yeah.
I don't know.
What are you reading? Like what genre most often?
Oh, man. I so diverse in my reading. Like, I love reading the Eric Larson books because they are just historical, but they're, written like novels, and his research seems predominantly original source research, and it's just fascinating. And I love reading anything where I get to study a senior leader or past presidents and their thinking. A lot of good biographies that I liked reading. Mm-hmm. Man, I don't know. It's hard to say. But but even with medicine, if there were only one book that I were going to recommend to peers and counterparts in my community, if you're only ever going to read one book about cancer, I recommend the book The Cancer Code, that I will probably read a few more times. There was also another one that I really hang on to called How to Starve Your Cancer Without Starving Yourself. And it really kind of talks about just blocking pathways that feed the cancer, right? And some of it is probably less applicable to neuroendocrine cancer because it's a lot slower reproduction and metabolism. I don't know if that's the right term, but it's a lot slower, right? So it doesn't respond to the same things per se as other cancers. There were recommendations and considerations in that book that resonated with me that I also found helpful.
Okay, I like
and
that.
It's nice as a cancer patient to feel like you have a little bit of empowerment.
Yeah.
There's something I can do on my own, and just being empowered and informed, life seem less out of control or chaotic or helpless in a dynamic where you just don't have control over it.
Mm-hmm. But
I've always dealt with uncertainty pretty well, and thank God for that, because there's a lot of uncertainty in being a cancer patient.
So. Yeah. How do you think that we can incorporate a lot of that in earlier on, right? I think that in college and in high school, and yes, you're interacting with your peers and all of that, but get people to really feel empathy and feel that connection with others that may be going through exactly what you're going through or something completely opposite of you, and giving you perspective. Because I think everybody's going through something all the time. And I think it really shapes who you become, right?
We have to humanize the issues and the challenges that we all face. And I might turn that question back to you,
yeah,
right? Because you are someone that is part of my cancer journey. And I could be just one of 1,000 patients that you came across.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that as I approach my care too, that I needed to show that I was invested. I needed to show that I wanted to give back. I needed to show that, as with, you know, everything in my life, I want to be part of the answer. I've also very much operated under the philosophy of, if you're not part of the answer, you're part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. In so many things in life,
yeah.
You know, if you're just going to be complacent and you're going to sit back and you'll be like, yeah, that's a dumpster fire, and you're not going to do anything about it, then you're part of the problem. That's just my opinion.
It's very true.
Yeah. So I try to, you know, be engaged. And then I try also to humanize my story, because I think it's easy to have in certain communities, whether it's medicine, whatever it is, right? In certain communities, when you look at subcultures of communities, it's easy to fall victim to compassion fade or mm-hmm. compassion fatigue. And you're dealing with tragedy every day. Then it's like, oh, this is the norm.
Yeah.
No, it's not the norm.
It's like, no.
Yeah. And to a certain degree, I think if you are a caregiver, you have to have some protective barriers. But to another degree, we got to remember, like, hey, like I'm someone's mom. And at the time I got my diagnosis, our son was 10 months old.
Yeah.
And I am someone's sister. And to them, I'm their baby sister.
Right.
And I'm someone's daughter. And I'm someone's leader, maybe, right? And that's really hard, too, if a mentor, a coach, a teacher is being taken out of the fight, or they might lose them. And so remembering these things and just remembering who we are to each other, I think, is how we do it, and then showing up for one another. So part of what I've done in the last several years since my cancer diagnosis, and then mismanaging my first year of my diagnosis, and then realizing, oh, I need to approach this differently.
Mm-hmm.
I got really involved in the community at the time, LACNETS, now the Neuroendocrine Cancer Foundation. Mm-hmm. They have a really great peer cancer group that meets virtually. I tried so hard to find an in-person group and could not find any, because this was right when COVID had hit, right after we kind of went through the flattening the curve and all that kind of stuff. And so everything had gone virtual.
Mm-hmm.
But there was kind of a beauty to the virtual group, to where people would resonate their stories with each other, or they like different energies from different people, and they would request contact information. Ultimately, I started providing peer support to a lot of others in the group. And of course, I get peer support from them in return. But some of it's sharing like doctors and specialties and things that we've learned. Some of it's talking about symptoms and how to manage. Some of it is talking about family challenges and just being emotional supports for each other, right? And just showing up for one another. Whether it's through text messaging, whether it's through phone call, whether it's whatever it is, and knowing like, hey, now is the time that I got to stop what I'm doing and I got to talk to this person, even if it's for 5 minutes. And then we'll talk, and then we'll figure out a good time to have a longer talk. And some of them I have never met, but you would think we're old friends,
right,
of years and years. And some of them, when I'm in their area, because I have rare cancer, will travel. When I travel for care, like, I'll look them up and I'll be like, hey, are you around? I'm at your city, you know, and I've gone out with some friends in New Orleans, and these are other neuroendocrine cancer patients. I have gone out to lunch with friends in Washington, D.C.,
mm-hmm.
I've driven from Maryland. I mean, just building community and showing up for one another and humanizing our stories and humanizing other stories, recognizing the people who give so much of their life and they've dedicated their lives to finding the answers for people like me. Showing up for them. I've spoken at a few different events for both caregivers in pharmaceutical companies and our neuroendocrine cancer specialists, and talk about the impact that they have in our lives. I mean, it just humanizing it, humanizing the long hours and the 2 a.m. you know, research for the microbiologists. I mean, like, when they don't get to meet people like me, and they don't get to see where the research goes all the time, right? We have to remember that we are not stories, we are people, and that our stories can help others connect to us, I think.
Yeah, I hope that anybody listening and in general, people do take that message and take it both literally and look a little bit deeper and look around at their lives and look around at the people and communities in their lives, right? There's people everywhere that need something or need some help, either empowering them or getting them on their feet or, like you said, just listening. And so I think we would all do a little bit better doing that. And I think things go a really long way in general. You said your sister was a year older than you. You definitely are very much like older sister vibes. Is she, yeah. Do you guys have the roles reversed, or is she also very much an older sister?
It's funny you ask that. You know, people say that to me a lot, actually. And there are a lot of studies that talk about the role reversal when your siblings are close in age. I wouldn't say that. Maybe there are certain elements that sometimes they're reversed. But she's definitely got big sister vibe too.
Father younger than you guys, or is he the eldest?
My brother is older as well. I have three sisters and a brother, but my other two sisters are I think 13 12 and 13 years older.
So my brother baby.
10 years older. I am, yeah. And and then I have a sister that's a little over a year.
I would not have guessed that at all.
I get that a lot too.
The same. Are you guys all super responsible and
we are? I don't know. I mean, yes. Just, they're gonna be like, all have gone out on their paths very differently, but my family is very dynamic, and you get us together, and it's always a good time. Yes.
I love that. Are you guys close by, live near each other? Or
oh, my gosh, we are spread all over. We are spread everywhere. My brother lives in Oklahoma. My sister's in Wisconsin. My mom's in Minnesota. Another sister in Kansas, and one in Georgia, you know, just all over the place.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Okay. That makes it fun when you get together, though. There's a lot to catch up on.
Anytime there's a wedding or something like that, it's really just a family reunion.
Nice.
And it's just a big party.
I love that. What's a conspiracy theory you kind of believe? That's a nice one, right?
A conspiracy theory I kind of believe. Just any random thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny.
It has to be one.
I don't know if this falls under conspiracy theory or not, but I would say I was thinking this morning that sometimes I think that maybe we have a consciousness on like a cellular level.
Okay. Elaborate.
And I mean like... and I'm not necessarily talking about like ESP and like telekinesis per se, but man, I was kind of thinking about this idea of manifesting, right? That people talk about with you throw it out into the universe and it's going to happen or what have you. And I was kind of like having this moment of reflection this morning as I was getting ready. And so I don't know. So I think that maybe on a cellular level, when we connect to people, that it can share a consciousness, right? Our cells can share a consciousness. And I know as a scientist, you're like, oh, you're crazy, right?
I see where you're going.
But it's just so bizarre. And I mean, my wife could attest to this. I will have someone that I haven't talked to for months or even years, and I'll just be thinking about them, and I'll say something about them to my wife, and then like 2 hours later that person will text me out of nowhere. I'll be like, oh my gosh, you walked by, you just sent me a text message. Of course, to a certain degree, that coincidence, right? But I mean, it happens
often
at an uncommon rate for, you know. And so I think, yeah, I don't know, maybe if we truly connect to people, and we hold space for one another, and we show up for each other, then maybe we are truly connecting to people.
Yeah. You know, I believe that. I don't think this is a conspiracy theory. I think there has to be some truth to it to an extent. I can meet somebody and they don't have to say a word, and you'll get a feeling about where you think this is going or how you think about this person, or And that has to be something. I don't know what it is, but there's a reason that our body feels a certain way. Or when you can feel, okay, I'm in an unsafe place, right? Your body feels it for no reason, right? You're with somebody that you've been with multiple times and you're like, okay, I need to be in a public area right now, or I can't be alone, or I can't close a door right now, or I can't. You have these gut feelings, and I don't think that's for nothing. So this is probably very similar to that, right? Like there's something. I don't know what it is, but there's something there.
And I agree with all of those things. It's this very intuitional sensing type communication that it feels too strong to just be a thought, right? Yeah. And so it's hard to explain, but it's almost tangible when it's happening.
So there's something there. Okay, that's definitely not a conspiracy theory, though.
It's true.
It's true. So you debunked it. Oh my God.
But that's all conspiracy theorists think, right? Like, it's true.
It's true. It's true. It's very true. But some of them are really wild.
Yeah.
If they are true, I'm scared.
Right.
Oh my goodness. If you were to look back, and I know it was hard for you to say best and worst experiences, but can you think of an experience that you think truly shaped you as a person, not necessarily in a career pattern, but just as a person, something that was pivotal in your life and why?
I got another crazy story for you.
Yeah.
I was 18 years old and I was at an emergency medicine camp that we would go to, I think twice a year we did this. So I was in a special program called Opportunities in Emergency Healthcare. And so I spent half of my day doing emergency medical, you know, education and training and things like that. But anyways, my senior year in high school, one of the girls that was in this program with me was also on the high school softball team with me. And we had to drive back from the camp about 2 hours away, go to a softball game, and then go back to the camp for one of the days so we didn't miss a game. And about an hour into the drive, we're like 60 miles an hour going down the highway. Everything's great. And we go through an intersection. And as we're going through this intersection, my car stalls. It just stalls. And we coast and about a block and get out. We're like, oh, man, this is back in the day where there weren't cell phones. So we had to actually walk to a payphone. And you actually had to have like quarters too. So we walk back. We start walking back toward the intersection. And I was like, oh, my gosh, we're never going to make it to the softball game. We had such a hard time.
God.
There, and we're like, all right, let's go. You know, so we went over, we did a triage, we provided care for six different victims of the accident. And two of them were trapped in a vehicle that was wedged. And we did quick care for the others and got in there and stabilized the driver. And I found out that the passenger was not breathing and did not have a pulse. Couldn't get them out of the vehicle. So I laid the car seat down as far as I could recline it. And I administered CPR on her while she was in the vehicle. Fire department showed up. And this is a really small town, like 300 people population, Rice, Minnesota, that we just had. It's one light town, literally. Fire department shows up. And all of a sudden, they just get incredibly emotional. A couple of them started to cry. Some of them were just really rattled, you could tell. Turns out that the couple that Jenny and I were working on in that vehicle were the fire chief and his wife.
Oh my goodness.
He had been the fire chief in that town for like 30 years. Friday, and that following Monday, they were going to come in and measure for new lights and I think maybe an overpass. He'd been fighting for an overpass to be put in that intersection for decades because of the number of accidents that had happened there. And he and his wife fell victim to a car accident in that same intersection. So it's one of those things where healthcare workers, emergency medicine responders, oftentimes do not work on their own friends or family for a reason. It's difficult to overcome the emotionality of the moment. But Jenny and I were there and we did everything we could and we got them extricated and sent off to the hospital and got a pulse back on his wife before she left the scene.
Oh, nice.
Fighting, yeah, which gave a fighting chance. And they were an older couple, and she got to the hospital. I think she only survived for another like 24, 48 hours, and then had too many internal injuries. So she sadly did not make it. And then her husband, a few days after that, also passed away. But they said that he just died from a broken heart. He didn't have like any significant injuries. So they said that he just like lost the will to thrive and to survive. And so,
oh my goodness.
Bringing this back around to your question of moments that have really shaped me, that whole experience at 18 years old and just everything that came from it, thinking number one of how that fire department was for this elderly couple, and just thinking to myself, man, everybody is somebody's somebody, and everybody needs to be treated with the dignity and
respect,
that they are somebody's somebody. And I have tried very hard to approach caring for others and providing leadership for others with that in mind, because that experience was just absolutely formative for me. And then also the idea that you could just die of a broken heart, that you could just lose your will to thrive and fight through something hard when your driver was gone, right? And and that has become something for me, especially in these last few years with my cancer battle, and then, you know, fighting to trying to continue despite my medical condition, having to focus on keeping that fire alive inside. There were several times in my cancer journey where in 2023, I think there's three times I almost did not survive. And I think sometimes it was just sheer will. Some people might call it stubbornness that know me really well, but I think it was just, I like to say sheer will. And as one of my good friends says, grit, that just got me through those moments. But had I not had the drivers of being there for my son for as long as I can be, and not wanting my wife to have to grieve that kind of loss and to leave her as a widower, I don't know if I would have made it through those moments. So, and then also just the tragedy and that whole, and the story, right? He was the fire chief. He'd been fighting to fix that problem, to care for and protect others. And just 2 days before it was supposed to be resolved, or before it was supposed to break ground on resolving it. Just the tragedy in that part of the story, those things, the preciousness of time and the sense of urgency that we have to have with certain things in life, all of those lessons were very transformative for me.
Yeah, I can only imagine. I mean, it was definitely right place, right time. That delay that happened for you guys happened for a reason. You know, there's sometimes there's things that you can't plan and you can't see coming, and you will never realize why or how, but there was a reason that you guys had that stop. And that's incredibly difficult, but it's incredibly, like you said, transformative and really just eye-opening that life can turn on a second, right? I mean, nobody can see something like that coming, and doing everything you can to savor every moment, right? Whether that's spending time with the people that you love, or putting that phone down sometimes and just looking around you, taking in as much as you can of every minute, because I think life is a lot shorter than we think it is. So you make all these plans and you have all these set timelines for life, and life has its own timeline for you.
Yeah,
that's a tough one.
Sure.
It's a tough one.
That is.
If you had to make a decision on whether you would have to lose all your past memories or never make new ones, do you have a preference? And does your diagnosis change that answer at all for you?
Oh, wow, man. I don't know. I think if I had to choose, I mean, because I don't want either of those.
I know.
You know, I guess I'd want to keep my past memories rather than new ones. And I say that, I mean, I've had a lot of really atypical experiences in my life, and I recognize that, and they very much have shaped me to who I am. And that doesn't mean they were all wonderful experiences. Obviously, having cancer is the greatest experience that you can have beautiful experiences in that. And with the connection of the people that I've connected to and being there for others, it's also been a fire hose lesson in humanity, both positive and negative. And I wouldn't want to let go of that. But ultimately, another thought that I try to keep sight of is that there's beauty in the struggle. And I think Nietzsche probably said it in a much more eloquent terms, but essentially talked about feeling all of the feels, as we say today, right? Like he wished they feel everything, the tragedy, the devastation, the elation, the joy, the abandonment, the togetherness, all of the things, because in his estimation, you are not fully living unless you are fully living, right? Unless you've had all of the spectrum of experiences that one could have. He was, of course, a little nihilistic, but I would say that I've really come to understand that sentiment in the last several years, and identifying people that have showed up for those moments, for when you're feeling all of the things and you're experiencing all of the spectrum of emotions that life can bring. I wouldn't want to forget that. I wouldn't want to forget who those people were. I also wouldn't want to forget those people who didn't show up. And I wouldn't want to forget those people who took advantage of the situation and the negative light of humanity, because it exists. And I wouldn't want to forget who I am and why I am who I am and what I have contributed, because I've done my best. And what is life if it's not contributing to a greater whole?
Yeah. If you had one piece of advice to leave people with, what would it be?
Believe you can. I mean, it's pretty simple. Mm-hmm. We can do hard things, and you never truly know what your limits are until they're challenged. And then you find, nope, wasn't there. Still haven't hit it yet, you know? And even when you do hit your limit, it's okay to be like, okay, I'm okay here. And just know that that you can take on things that you can't even imagine. So just know that you can believe in yourself, believe that there is more out there for you to do and more out there for you to take on and more to experience in life and go after it, you know, just get out there and get after it. Life is just a collection of experiences waiting to happen, and don't squander it, because every day is a gift.
Love that. What are you most excited for that's coming up next?
I don't know. I'm really looking forward to being back on the East Coast, because we have a lot of connections out there. We have a lot of history out there. The nation has a lot of history out there. We're kind of history buffs, you know. So that's fun. So I'm looking forward to that. We've got some good friends out there too, and it's always a good time to get back around friends that you've had for a long time. And
yeah,
I think there are a lot of galas that we could probably go to for different, you know, events and such in DC.
Sorry.
It's a good time to move into that chapter of our lives.
I love that. DC is amazing. If you had to leave the West Coast, I think DC is definitely not the worst place to be.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people would say the opposite of that. We've lived there.
Really?
It's like any big city. There's the grind of the city and the traffic, and that you can always find a million things to complain about. But I totally agree. I mean, there's so many great things to do out there. There's a lot of positive things to look forward to.
Yeah. And we'll be closer, at least for the time being. I'm moving to Italy later this year, but we'll be closer, at least when I come home.
Moving to Italy?
And direct flights. I am moving to Italy for med school, yes.
Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh.
I'm very excited.
How fun.
Yeah, you gotta come visit.
I mean, my mom actually just asked me like a week ago if I wanted to go on a trip to Italy next year. And I was like, yeah, we'll see what the schedule looks like. I'd love to. We've done one before, and that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, we'll definitely have to connect if we make it out there, for sure.
I absolutely will. This was super fun.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
Hope you have a good week, and nothing goes smoothly.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll see you soon.
Bye.